Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Arnie Gundersen, an energy advisor with Fairwinds Associates, a company who provide research, analysis and paralegal services around environmental and energy issues. Arnie Gundersen has 39 years of nuclear power engineering experience, and during his nuclear industry career, Arnie managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants around the United States. He currently speaks on television, radio and at public meetings on the need for a new paradigm in energy production. An independent nuclear engineering and safety expert, Arnie provides testimony on nuclear operations, reliability, safety and radiation issues to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, congressional and state legislatures and government agencies and officials throughout the US, Canada and internationally. Arnie Gundersen, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hi, thank you for having me, Helen.
Well, Arnie, things are going from bad to worse, right, at Fukushima?
They're certainly not getting any better.
But Arnie, did they know right at the beginning that there was a meltdown within the first few hours in Unit 1? Did they sit on that data and cover it, or did they not know?
I think there's three agencies involved. I think the Japanese on the scene wanted to believe the best.
Yeah.
And I've seen that at Chernobyl, and I saw that at Three Mile Island.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you have two instruments, one is awful and one is good, you believe the one that's good. But pretty quickly, I think at management levels, they knew things were really bad. But moving up the chain through the government became a real problem there. The second agency involved was the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and they have a charter to promote nuclear power. So I don't think we were going to get a very strong statement out of them early on. And then the last one is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and it's now apparent that they knew and didn't tell.
Why?
Well, behind the scenes, we know from Wall Street Journal yesterday that they were there was private meetings at the ambassador level where the United States was telling Japan that you're about ready to lose northern Japan. So that didn't come from the State Department. It obviously came from the NRC. So the NRC knew but chose not to tell.
Why?
Oh, I think it's the same thing, Helen. I think it's promoting nuclear power.
They are evil. I can't say anything else. Look, in medicine, you have to have informed consent from a patient about every procedure you do, and you have to tell them what could happen, that you might rupture their esophagus, they might develop peritonitis. If, you know, the tube goes through the esophageal wall or whatever, you have to be honest. That's now legal. And yet here we have an industry which is pouring radiation into the atmosphere and the water, damaging people's genes for the rest of time. And they're lying, Arnie, they're lying. They can't, I mean, it's almost beyond my belief as a doctor to imagine how these people can be so wicked.
Well, they also turned off, the EPA here in the States, turned off the radiation monitors.
Yeah.
And we're discovering now that the air in Seattle, compared to the air in Tokyo, it was only half. There was almost half as much radioactive tiny particles, called hot particles, in the air in Seattle as it was in Tokyo. And yet, we're turning off the United States radiation detectors.
Why is the Environmental Protection Agency turning off the monitors?
Well, I wish I had a secret memo, but
yeah.
I think you've hit it on the head that there's a lot of industrial people who are concerned that they don't want this thing to frighten people. But in fact, I mean, you understand hot particles, and the air over Seattle was loaded with hot particles, as it was over Tokyo in April and May.
Okay, so Annie, explain to the audience what is a hot particle and what is it composed of, and what can it do once it gets into the body?
Well, it's very small. It's smaller than the thickness of a hair. But that has a lot of radioactive atoms in it. And what can happen is it can get ingested through saliva, which is why everybody was supposed to water their spinach. But it can also get inhaled and stick in your lung. And in either case, it's got a charge. The other word for these, Helen, is fuel fleas.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Because they're charged and they jump.
Do they jump?
Yeah. You'll see them jump to a charged surface. So these fuel fleas or hot particles have made their way across the Pacific, and at least the data for the Pacific Northwest indicates very high concentrations. About the average person in Seattle, well, the average person in Tokyo breathed in about 10 hot particles a day, and the average person in Seattle breathed in 6. So they're really, despite the ocean in between, there really wasn't much difference.
So are they composed of plutonium or... what are the elements in the hot particles, Arnie?
Well, we're seeing plutonium, americium, and uranium, which are very heavy. And we're also seeing strontium and cesium, which are quite heavy but not as heavy, and all of which emit a very powerful, either a beta ray or an alpha particle. And they slam into the internal tissue and disgorge their energy in a very small area. But they do it and do it and do it again and again and again as they decay. So it's an irritant in your lung or an irritant in your the bowel or in your pancreas.
Or liver.
Some of these wind up
or
on there.
Bone, yeah.
Yes, correct. And so that constant irritation over time can cause a cancer.
Well, the truth is, if you inhale 1/1,000,000th of a gram of plutonium and it stays in one place in your lung, and it does for, you know, months or years, irradiating a very small volume of cells, you're going to get cancer. But it takes, you know, 15 to 60 years for the cancer to develop for you to cough up your first amount of blood.
Well, I think that's what the industry was counting on. You know what? By turning off the monitors and saying everything's fine, they realized that 30 years from now or 10 years from now, if you get a cancer, it's impossible to trace that back to Fukushima. So it was a good way of, like an ostrich sticking her head in the sand, just hoping it would blow over.
I can't believe it. It's like having a patient in the ICU, in the intensive care unit, turning off the monitors and saying, we don't really want to know what's happening to this patient. You know, we'd rather not, you know. It's just, it's beyond my capacity as a physician, Arnie, having taken the Hippocratic Oath, to understand what these characters think they are flaming well up to. What I want to know from you, Arnie Gunderson, because you're on CNN, you're on all sorts of television programs, is there a rising tide of deep concern and indeed anger amongst the American people about this? This cover-up?
I think in the United States, more and more people have become concerned, especially in the last week.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to the doubling of the radiation estimate, and it's actually more like tripling, Helen, because they doubled what was released in the first week and are now comparing that to what was released.
Doubled the estimates.
The estimate. All of the detectors were blown to smithereens.
So it's all total estimates. They haven't a clue how much got out or is still getting out, right?
That's correct.
They have no idea. So how can they estimate if they have no monitors? They don't know what's happening, you know, and then they find, oh, my God, we've had a meltdown. Oh, my God, we've had another meltdown. How can they possibly estimate how much radiation escaped and is escaping into the air and water? How can they?
Well, I think the difference between this accident and Chernobyl is that scientists have the internet and they can be independent and share information.
Yeah.
We're seeing people are sending us automotive air filters from Japan.
Yeah.
And we're examining those in the lab. And the Fukushima air filters are so incredibly radioactive that I hope the mechanics are wearing gloves when they're working on it.
Oh, my God.
And we're seeing, even in Tokyo, the air filters in Tokyo are 30 times less radioactive than Fukushima, but they're still highly radioactive. So,
and what elements have they got? What are you measuring, the strontium, the cesium, the plutonium, the americium, or not? Or just you are?
All of that. Well, initially, the first swipe is hot particles. And then once we find the hot particle, we can use a scanning electron microscope to hone in on it and determine exactly what element it is. And we've seen a witch's brew, you know, the cesium-134, 137, strontium, et cetera. So they clearly were in the air in April and May because we've got the evidence now in the form of automotive air filters.
Okay, so now, and then I read during the last week, Arnie, that the Japanese government have decided that people can eat the radioactive food because they need to keep their farmers settled and in business and keep them happy so people can eat the radioactive food. Did you read that report too?
Yes, and the same with the school children, where they just suddenly said school kids can get what industrial workers can get. It's absurd, and it's unconscionable.
Yeah.
You know, I was on the radio the very first week saying that they should evacuate pregnant women and young children out to 40 kilometers at least.
Yeah.
And, in fact, they started at 10 and eventually got to 20. So they clearly did not want to provoke a panic. I think in their mind it is better to deal with the medical issues a year or 10 out than it is to lose money this year.
So is it money? I mean, there's always a statement, you shouldn't cry fire in a crowded theatre or you'll create panic and people, you know, trample over each other, try and get to the exit and kill each other in the process. Is it that sort of dynamic that they didn't want to create panic, A, or B, is it because they not wanted people to know so that their investments, which are absolutely huge in nuclear in Japan and the United States, would not be threatened?
I think both.
You
know, I'm conscious when I'm on CNN or when I'm on this show. You know, I try to temper my advice so it doesn't create a panic, but yet I think you have to be informed at the same time. And if things are really bad, an informed population needs to know that. And that didn't happen, with the exception of probably two or three of us, me and Dave Lockbaum from Union of Concerned Scientists and one or two others. All of the experts who are being paid by the industry wound up saying, well, it's not going to be a big problem.
They were lying.
They're kicking the can down the road, Helen. You know, they were saying that 10 years from now, we'll figure it out.
They're lying. They need to be indicted and jailed, obviously. That's what I would say as a physician. But let's get on to the next thing, Arnie. Here we are in the middle of the accident. We now learn that units 1, 2, and 3, which you predicted all along, have actually melted down. That unit 4 is very unstable with that huge fuel pool on top of the building, full of huge amounts of radioactive materials, and the building is tilting. We have the molten fuel in units 1, 2, and 3 hitting the concrete floor. Possibly there could be a hydrogen explosion. We have the possibility of an aftershock, a big earthquake. Can you just sketch the possibilities of how another major accident could occur, and now the winds have turned and they're blowing south over Japan and the rains are coming? Just sort of outline, illustrate the scenario, possible scenarios that could occur now on, Arnie Gundersen.
Well, I think Unit 1 probably can't get any more worse than it is. The fuel is melted through the nuclear reactor. It's lying on the floor, and it's boiling water as the water runs over it. That water has become incredibly radioactive. It's essentially in contact with radioactive plutonium and uranium and all those elements. And for all the units, they are simply running out of storage space. But Unit 1 is going to, that mass of bubbling hot uranium is going to gradually move down into the concrete, but I don't think there's enough energy to melt all the way through. But it really doesn't matter at this point because the radioactive material is leaving the containment. The containment has been breached. So Unit 2 is just as bad. There's a picture that came out yesterday of scalding hot water boiling up through a hole in the floor on Unit 1. That room, Helen, was 400 R an hour. In other words, it's lethal in 1 hour.
Okay, so let me tell people what an R is. An R is a REM. REM is a measurement of absorbed radiation dose into the body. If you receive a dose between 250 and 500 REMs, that is an LD50. In other words, a lethal dose for 50% of the population. You will die within a week or two with your hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death, like that man Litvinenko did, the Russian who was given some polonium. He died like that. So between 250 and 400 or 500. So you're saying, and that's in total, you're saying that they are measuring 400 REMs per hour?
Yes.
At that site in Unit 1.
Right. And similarly in Unit 2. Unit 2 still has the roof on, and it's so humid and so physically hot and so radioactively hot that nobody can go into it. So Unit 1 and 2 are as bad as they're going to get, are not getting any better. But I think they're just going to continue to ooze liquid and spray steam into the environment for months to come.
Mm-hmm.
Unit 3 is a little bit different. There's still a possibility of a steam explosion in Unit 3. Well, because not all of the core melted through, and there's a chance if a large hunk of core falls into the water under it, it could create a steam explosion. Unit 3's fuel pool and Unit 4's fuel pool are structurally so incredibly weak that I think my biggest fear now is a seismic aftershock. And if you remember the Sumatra earthquake of 4 or 5 years ago, that was a 9, just like Japan's, and there was a 8.6 3 months later. So Japan is not out of the woods as far as major aftershocks. Unit 4 is tilting, and Unit 3 is pretty much bombed out and destroyed. And a major earthquake could cause those fuel pools to fall. My advice to my friends in Japan is if you hear that fuel pool has collapsed, leave. Because there's no science here. No one ever thought of nuclear fuel lying on the ground and not being able to be cooled in a nuclear fuel pool. So we are beyond the point where anyone has ever analyzed if the fuel pools collapse. So if there's a major earthquake that causes the buildings to topple, my advice is leave.
Yeah, that's if you could get a plane out. I mean, maybe you should leave now. Because can't you imagine? I mean, there will be panic if people understand and everyone lining up at the airport to get on planes and there won't be enough planes.
Yeah. That's a major concern. And I don't know why TEPCO isn't frantically trying to reinforce that building. Obviously, it's so radioactive, it's difficult. But
what, this Unit 4 or Unit 3?
Unit 4. Unit 4.
Right.
Frantically get in there and shore it up with concrete and steel and stuff like that to prevent the unimaginable from occurring. But that has not happened.
And what about the winds and the rain blowing now south over Japan?
Yeah, well, now the plants are emitting radiation every day. And that wind
air.
Now, instead of heading out to sea predominantly, is now heading toward Tokyo. So we're seeing hot particles on the roadways. we're seeing hot particles in Tokyo now. There's a group of people who are monitoring, in lieu of the government, there's a group of people out there monitoring radiation and are basically developing a map of what's really occurring in Tokyo. Just 2 days ago, a university professor discovered plutonium a mile off-site in the soil. And about the same time, a group of inspectors found radiation in the ditches on the sides of the road to the tune of 10 millirem an hour, which is 200 times normal background. So it's falling onto the road, being washed into the ditches, and the ditches have become highly radioactive.
Oh, my God. What I don't understand, though, Arnie, is why... I know, yeah, okay, so they were protecting their, as we'd say in Australia, protecting their asses. So they didn't want people to know, but wouldn't you have thought that they would have invited the International Atomic Energy Agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, all the organisations in at the beginning to help them work out what on earth to do right at the start?
Well, again, if you look at the IAEA's charter, it's to promote nuclear power.
So they don't care about safety, but their charter does say it's got to be safe.
Yes.
As well as promote.
You know, they have that split charter where, one, they're promoting, and two, they're determining if it's safe. And we both know that doesn't work.
So they're being wicked. They're being wicked too. I mean, really wicked. And the other thing is that what you just said, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was sitting a day or two after the whole thing started saying they thought that the whole of the northern Japan could become uninhabitable. That's an amazing... Was that in the Wall Street Journal, Arnie?
That was in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. And it didn't say the NRC. It said the State Department was talking to the Japanese ambassador and trying to tell him the severity of the accident in his country. Now, the State Department doesn't have radiation experts. They were obviously getting that information
from the NRC.
The NRC, right.
Well, why isn't Hillary Clinton being more honest?
Well, Hillary Clinton, after Fukushima, entered a pact with the Japanese to buy more material. So, again, the commercial, short-term commercial interests seem to be driving...
By what sort of material?
You know, food and trucks and cars. But it was, as I recall, predominantly food and fish and things like that. It was an attempt to show the population of both countries that everything was fine.
How are we going to break through these people's psychic numbings, Arnie?
I think the internet is the difference, Helen, and
do
I
you?
Hope it is. I am constantly receiving reports that I pass on to other experts with data that over time will substantiate the magnitude of the releases, and then we can go back in and pin down what populations are at risk. And hopefully, give them the appropriate medical treatment.
Medical treatment, Arnie. I'm sorry, but once people have been contaminated with radioactive material, you can't get it out of their bodies. There's no medical treatment. And then people are writing to me and saying, well, what do I eat? What do I feed my children? Well, you are right. You've been saying, stay off milk products because milk, in fact, does bioconcentrate radioactive iodine and strontium and cesium. That's right. But then they've got to eat, and the vegetables concentrated, and the fruit concentrates it, and it falls into the water. The tea is concentrating the material in Japan now. You can't run. It's a kind of biblical ghastliness that once it's happened, there's no retreat. There's nothing you can do to change it.
Well, I'm most concerned about the fish. We're seeing, Woods Hole has said that the radioactive releases into the ocean are 10 times higher than the radioactive releases into the Baltic after Chernobyl.
Yeah.
And we're already seeing fish as far away as Hong Kong being detected with iodine. And high concentrations of cesium in fish as far away as 200 to 300 kilometers now. Now those fish will work their way up the food chain into, you know, the tuna and the salmon and the top of the food chain animals, and we'll see bioaccumulation over the next year as the cesium and as the strontium works its way up the food chain.
Well, and it's not just cesium and strontium, Arnie, that's pouring out into the ocean. I mean, wouldn't there be more than 100 different isotopes or radioactive elements like tellurium and zinc and calcium and all sorts of radioactive elements being poured in en masse into the ocean and there to bioconcentrate up through the crustaceans, no, the algae, the crustaceans, the little fish, the big fish, the tuna, the salmon. I mean, by orders of magnitude, there's bioconcentration at each step. So it's not just the cesium and strontium. Arnie, would you like to name a few of the other elements that are not often talked about?
Yeah, no, actually, I think you just nailed them, and polonium is another one. And I think, and again, we are not monitoring fish. And sooner or later, a shipment of tuna is going to fire off a radiation alarm as it enters the United States.
Well, if they've got a radiation alarm, you know, because they don't...
Well, our ports are monitored for terrorists.
I know,
so,
but...
So, you know, we'll pick it up in a terrorist radiation alarm.
Oh, you think so?
And we'll say, oh, my God, it's the tuna. I think that will happen in the next year to year and a half.
Well, what about the tuna being bought in Washington State, you know, or caught, or the fish, or, you know, because fish swim thousands of miles. And I hear that the EPA is not monitoring the fish that are being caught on the West Coast. Is that correct?
No, they're not. I think it's a little too early for measurable amounts.
Yeah.
The ocean currents have not carried much of the radiation to the east, to the west coast, and the bioaccumulation hasn't worked its way up the food chain too much. I think it's about a year out before we wind up with contaminated fish on the west coast of the U.S.
Now, what about, you live in you live in Vermont, and radioactive fallout is being detected in Massachusetts and in Vermont, in milk and the like. Tell us your scenario if there really is another major aftershock or a collapse of one of the reactor fuel, molten fuel masses, and there's a steam explosion, a hydrogen explosion or whatever. And, you know, what do you think could happen in the United States? Or is it because the winds now have turned from blowing east to west across the U.S. to blowing south over Japan, you think that'll make the U.S. relatively safe because the climatic conditions have altered?
No, I think you said it right earlier. You can run, but you can't hide at this point. You know, that these particles at a micron or two or three microns are small enough that they will get up in the jet stream and carry the way into the States and into Europe. So I'm not convinced that things like cesium and strontium, but that whole witch's brew that you discussed won't get here. Now, you know, will you be able to stand outside with a radiation detector and say, "Oh my God, there's a lot"? No, it's all about hot particles and ingesting a particle that then causes a lot of local damage in a lung or a GI tract or a pancreas or a bone. That leads to a cancer. It's but it's never going to be something where you can stand outside with your Geiger counter and detect it, which makes it so insidious.
Oh, it's insidious and cryptogenic and silent and insidious. What do you call them, those hot particles? Nuclear fleas?
Fuel fleas.
Fuel fleas, yeah, that's the language that nuclear engineers use. What gets me is that nuclear engineers know all this stuff, and I found it fascinating, your latest video, Arnie. You were talking about evacuation and how the NRC calculates how much radiation will get out if there's a meltdown. And you said that they determine that if there's a meltdown, only 1% of the melted material will escape, right? And then of that, I don't know, they cut it down so finely, and using those totally artificial estimates, they then work out who should be evacuated from where and from how far out from the plant. I mean, that was an amazing thing to me, Arnie.
Well, no, thank you. Yeah, the website is Fairwinds for your listeners with an E in the middle. The industry and the NRC got together and came up with assumptions, and they are purely guesses at how much radiation can be released. And at each step along the way, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller to the point that we have very, very small evacuation zones. And that's all about money. You know, it's all about a plan to remove people from a very close-in distance is obviously a lot cheaper than a plan to go out to, I'm suggesting, 80 kilometers.
You're suggesting 80 kilometers of evacuation zone, but how could you possibly evacuate people around Indian Point from 80 kilometers around? You know, you've got Westchester and, you know, highly populated areas reaching right down to New York.
Well,
talk about gridlock.
Everybody has known since the 70s that locating Indian Point that close to New York City was a mistake. And yet, you know, we're considering giving them a 20-year license extension. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It didn't make a lot of sense 40 years ago to do it, and why do we want to double down on that bet for another 20?
Well, Arnie, we know that there's a big movement now of people living around Indian Point and indeed in Manhattan to oppose Indian Point. They actually want it shut down, not the lifetime extended. Do you think that movement's going to be powerful enough with the NRC and the powers that be to do that?
Well, the NRC has never not approved a license extension.
I know.
But in the case of Indian Point, there's the state of New York is against it.
Yeah.
And the governor of New York is against it. So for the first time, there's a political coalition that may affect whether that plant runs for an extra 20 years.
Are you going to be able to close down Vermont Yankee, seeing that your governor wants to and the Senate's voted for closing it down, and yet there's a lawsuit from Entergy, who owns the blasted thing, to keep it going?
Well, the people of Vermont have spoken, and that's that the unit should be shut down. Entergy is suing the state, and now it's a legal battle, and I don't really want to speculate on what a federal judge is going to decide.
No. Right in your bones, Arnie Gundersen, nuclear engineer, give us your sort of gut feeling, emotional reaction to what is now going on and has been going on in Fukushima, from all your knowledge and background and understanding.
Well, I guess there's a bunch of feelings. A deep sadness for the people off-site, an incredible respect for the workers who are risking their lives. I mean, these people know that the likelihood of a cancer is much, much increased, and yet they go to work every day. But, you know, at its core, I feel deep respect for Mother Nature. And I have really come to the understanding that we are not smart enough to outsmart Mother Nature. There will be something thrown at a power plant that we haven't anticipated, whether it's a tsunami, an earthquake, a hurricane, a tornado, God knows what. But man is not smart enough to manage one of these, given what Mother Nature can throw at us.
So you used to think, as a nuclear engineer, that man was smart enough to master Mother Nature, did you?
Oh yeah, when I left college, the math behind nuclear power is enthralling. I mean, now I have a saying: sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs.
Oh, that's too true, Arnie. That's too true. What we really have to do now is to rise above the wave of money and power. You know, the last thing we haven't discussed is President Obama's absolute fixation on nuclear power. Do you want to just briefly mention
Well, his largest campaign contributor early on was Exelon, and they have 17 nuclear power plants. So it doesn't surprise me that the advisors he chose are pro-nuclear. I don't think he's getting good advice. The money for new nukes doesn't make any sense. They are so astronomically costly in comparison to alternative energy and smart grids that I don't know why we're doing it. On closing the old ones, I'm sure, again, that gets to the point where all of his advisors have a vested interest in that outcome.
Yeah, but wouldn't you think that man is intelligent enough, Arnie, and intuitive enough, and he's a father of two little daughters he adores, to really get it?
I think he relies on his advisors, and compared to an economy in the tank and two wars and things like that, he doesn't spend a lot of time on his energy policy. In fact, energy policy is the root of the economic problems and the root of the wars.
Yep.
But I don't think in Washington they see it that way. I think they see the energy policy as a separate deal. In fact, it's at the bottom of all our problems.
Well, I think we should close with a statement from President Jefferson that is always apt. An informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And Arnie Gundersen, you are an outstanding informer, teacher, lecturer. You have been at the forefront of this dreadful, ghastly accident right from the start. And I respect you very much for that, Arnie. Without you, David Lockbaum's done great work too, but you've been right there. And I would like to say to the viewers that Arnie does it all for free. And, you know, he's not being paid to do this, whereas the nuclear people, they get paid. So if anyone has a bit of spare cash and would like to help to save the world, it would definitely help Arnie and Maggie in the wonderful work they're doing.
Well, thank you, Helen. There's a donate button on the Fairwind site.
Yep, good. Arnie, thank you, my love. And we will be interviewing you again in a few weeks for another really ghastly update, I suppose.
Oh, I hope not.
No.
Thank you very much.
Okay, love to you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Arnie Gundersen, an energy advisor with 39 years' experience of nuclear power engineering in the United States. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. Now you will hear an excerpt from a speech I gave at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Congress in Berlin on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl in April 2011.
I'm also dedicating this lecture to my friend and sister, Petra Kelly. Petra and I worked almost hand in hand. She did Europe and I did the United States during the 1980s when the threat of nuclear war was impending, when Ronald Reagan said over an open microphone, I've pressed the button, the missile, I'm paraphrasing, missiles have been launched. I met with Reagan in the White House for an hour and a quarter. I established quickly a doctor-patient relationship with him. I held his hand for at least half that time. He knew nothing about nuclear weapons or delivery systems or CIA reports. I just finished my book, Missile Envy, and so I would correct him. He would then get a malar flush, become very anxious, so I had to hold his hand to reassure him. I estimated his IQ to be average 100, but I also came out of the meeting saying I thought he had impending Alzheimer's disease, which indeed he did. He was the commander-in-chief in charge of thousands of hydrogen bombs with a three-minute decision time whether or not to launch. This is a very sad time in the history of the world. I have often imagined a major nuclear meltdown and have said for many years that that will end the nuclear industry. I never imagined four reactors having various stages of meltdowns built on an earthquake fault, by a very capable people, the Japanese, and the fuel pools melting as well. I never imagined it. When I first heard about it 4 weeks ago, being a physician, I extrapolated the prognosis. If indeed one or more of those reactors break through the containment and we have another Chernobyl or two Chernobyls, that will mean millions of cases of cancer in the Northern Hemisphere. How hard do we work to try and save a child's life who's dying of leukemia or Wilms tumour? How hard do we work to try and save a woman's life who's dying of metastatic breast cancer? The medical dictum says if we have an incurable disease, the only way and recourse is prevention. The nuclear industry was begun... Well, I've got a fascinating book here. It's called Radioactive. It's about Madame Curie and Pierre Curie. And it's relevant, I think. When they first discovered X-rays, electricity, radio, the telegraph, the X-rays and radioactivity, at the turn of the 20th century, a series of invisible forces were radically transforming daily life. The advances were dazzling. For some time, they blurred the boundary between science and magic. If invisible light could pass through flesh and expose a human skeleton, was it so fantastical to believe in levitation, in telekinesis, in communicating with the dead? And this began a whole spiritualist movement in the mid-19th century, which seduced millions who were promising contact with the divine through ghosts and spirits. So we've always been fascinated with radiation, as was Madame Curie and Pierre Curie. They gave birth to death. Madame Curie died of aplastic anemia induced by radium. Pierre Curie, he was run over by a horse and buggy. Her daughter, she died of leukemia too. We have known since the beginning of the nuclear age that that radiation induces cancer. However, we're in the middle of a huge argument. The problem is the nuclear physicists since the dawn of the nuclear age, and I knew many of them, they were my friends. George Kistiakowsky, who supplied the implosion mechanism for the first A-bomb. Vicky Wyskoff, Philip Morrison, Edward Teller, who I debated, and I beat him. Jerry Wiesner, who was Jack Kennedy's science advisor. Ted Taylor, who developed the suitcase hydrogen bomb. I knew them all. They were racked with guilt because they had helped to vaporise and kill over 200,000 people in a flash of light in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They thought if they could harness atoms for peace, then they could go to their graves relatively not guilty. They all went to their graves guilty. They knew right from the beginning the toxicity of plutonium. In fact, Glenn Seaborg, who developed plutonium-239, spoke about it at the beginning. Plutonium is so toxic that when injected into beagle dogs, there wasn't a dose low enough that didn't give every dog cancer, 10 to the minus 9 grams. It's said that a microgram is definitely carcinogenic, but it may be much lower. Each reactor manufactures 250 kilos of plutonium per year. It's only needed 2.5 kilos to make yourself an atomic bomb. The half-life of plutonium is 24,400 years. It lasts for 250,000 years or more. It is handled like iron by the body. It's an iron analogue. If inhaled, it induces lung cancer. And let me just point out that the nuclear industry is lying. It lies continuously. It talks about permissible doses of radiation. As we all know as physicians, there is no permissible dose of radiation. As we know as physicians, it is background radiation that induced evolution. Advantageous genes survived. Fish developed lungs. Birds developed wings. We, this magnificent species with a huge neocortex, opposing thumbs, standing on our hind legs, evolved. I happen to think we're an evolutionary aberrant. But most mutations are deleterious and induce disease. As we know, we all carry several hundred genes for disease, cystic fibrosis, diabetes, phenylketonuria, inborn errors of metabolism, dwarfism. There are now 2,600 genetic diseases described. Most are recessive. And yet George Monbiot, in his wisdom, accrued over 3 days reading some scientific and medical literature, said that surprisingly no genetic abnormalities were seen in the offspring of the Hibakusha at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why not? Because either they were fatal mutations, there were many spontaneous abortions, many children have been born with gross congenital abnormalities, which are almost certainly teratogenic. And this is described in this wonderful book put together by Yablokov, and I can't wait to hear him speak later on, and Nestorenko, two Nestorenkos. Photographs of children with phocomelia, babies were born with anencephaly, cyclops, spina bifida, you name it. There are homes full of children in Belarus and Ukraine, of grossly deformed children. But most mutations are recessive, and it takes up to 20 generations for two recessive genes, i.e. cystic fibrosis, to get together to form a child with that particular disease. George Monbiot and his colleagues know nothing about genetics. Why? Because we have not taught them. The physicists all this time have prevailed since the 1940s in the Manhattan Project. When the physicists from Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore go to Congress, they almost have a Merlin's cap. They're magic. They walk into Congress, a red carpet's laid out in front of them, and the Congress people virtually lie down in front of them metaphorically, because they've harnessed the energy inside the centre of the sun, E equals MC squared, the most enormous energy. What did Einstein say? The splitting, and this is the most profound statement I probably could make today, the splitting of the atom changed everything. All reality, save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. They think of nuclear bombs like they thought of swords and jousting and pistols. They still think like that. The Pentagon talks like that. It's not the Department of Defense, it's the Department of Death. America is spending almost $1 trillion a year on death, and it doesn't have even a free medical care system, because that's socialist or even communist. We are in a very terrible situation, and peaceful nuclear energy arose from these scientists' brains, capturing the heat of splitting the atom to boil water. As Einstein said, nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water, and that's all nuclear power does. But in each reactor is as much the uranium becomes 1 billion times more radioactive when fissioned in the reactor, 1 billion times. 200 new isotopes are made, some with half-lives of seconds, some with billions of years. And the nuclear industry talk about external radiation, background radiation. It used to be 170 millirems a year. Suddenly it's become okay to say it's 350 millirems a year. I said to my colleague Arjun Makajani, how did it suddenly rise and double? He said, oh, they're adding radon to background radiation. Some people live in houses with radon, most do not. No background radiation is safe. It adds already to the numbers of cancers we see now, maybe 30% or more. The Bear Report of the National Academy of Sciences, number 7, said that no radiation is safe, it's cumulative. Yet, everyone gets a dental X-ray once a year. Alice Stewart, she discovered that one X-ray to the pregnant abdomen to the fetus doubles the incidence of leukemia in that child's lifetime. She was shunned by the nuclear industry for years and made fun of. Her data now stands and is accepted with scientific validity. We do not learn in medical school what internal emitters are. I did not learn what gamma radiation was, but I learnt later that it is produced by radioactive isotopes, cesium, strontium, cobalt-60, and we use it in the treatment of cancer. People are confused. Why do we use radiation to treat cancer? We don't explain that radiation kills actively dividing cells. That's why the fetus is thousands of times more radiosensitive than adults. Why babies and children are 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive. We've got X-ray machines at airports to walk through. They're radiating fetuses. They're irradiating babies. They're irradiating immunocompromised people. This is wicked. And what do we do? Nothing. What did I learn? I was not taught in medical school what an alpha emitter was. I was not taught it was a particulate composed of two protons and two neutrons, which travels not very far. It doesn't penetrate dead layers of epidermis to damage living dermal cells, but it's grossly mutagenic. And it produces high levels of radiation to a very small volume of cells in the lung. Tiny volume. And as radiation decreases with the square of the distance, most cells die, but on the periphery of that volume, cells remain viable and mutate and develop cancer. People do not understand the latent period of carcinogenesis. They think that if you get irradiated, you'll drop dead. Sure. If you get 250 to 500 REMS, LD50, half the people will die of acute radiation illness, as the liquidators died and the liquidators at Fukushima are now dying. But to get cancer takes, as we know from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, leukemia 5 to 10 years, solid cancers 15 to 60 years. Do we explain that to the public? Do we tell them that no cancer wears an identifying badge saying it was made by some strontium-90, you ate in a piece of chocolate, Hershey's chocolate, 20 years ago, as Three Mile Island is 15 miles from Hershey's chocolates, and had a major meltdown, and many people were impacted. I didn't learn about, I want to just finish, plutonium, iron analogue, combines with transferrin, transferred to the mediastinal lymph glands where it can cause lymphoma, stored in the liver where it causes liver cancer, goes to the bone marrow for hemoglobin, causes osteogenic sarcoma or leukemia, crosses the placenta which lets nothing pass except iron, where, like thalidomide, it's teratogenic. It has a predilection for testicles and deposits just next to the spermatogonia, the precursors of the sperm, where it induces mutations that will be passed on generation to generation. While if the man is cremated, his smoke goes out the chimney to get into another man's testicles. And so we can see an exponential increase in genetic disease and deformities for the rest of time, called random compulsory genetic engineering. How dare they? And we're not the only species with genes. 30 million other species cohabit the planet with us, all of which have genes, all of which develop congenital deformities and genetic disease and malignancies. I didn't learn about beta radiation, which is given off by radioactive iodine-131. I didn't learn about beta radiation given off by cesium-137. I didn't know what cesium was. It's a potassium analogue, ubiquitous in the body, induces brain cancers, rhabdomyosarcomas, rare as hen's teeth. I didn't learn about cobalt-60, which is not a fission product, but an activation product. I wrote about all of this in this book recently, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. People don't understand that internal emitters induce very high doses of radiation. It's not low-dose radiation, it's high dose. High dose. And yet we don't teach them this. And without understanding, we have an uninformed population. An informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion, and that's what we did in the 80s. We informed people about the medical implications of nuclear war. Most Americans in 78 said to me, oh, it's better to be dead than red. I said, really? They said, yeah, we don't want to be communist. So we started doing the bombing run and dropping bombs on Boston and describing the medical implications. Vaporization up to 5 miles, lethal burns up to 20 miles, and they'd wake up in the morning and look at the Boston Globe and say, ooh, nuclear war is bad for our health. In 5 years, we educated 80% of Americans to be opposed to the concept of nuclear war. Petra and all of you educated Germany and Europe. The whole world rose up and helped to lead to the end of the Cold War. However, the weapons were not removed. We are living with death machines. Death, which is silent, cryptogenic, latent, takes a long time to develop. Only we, the medical profession, understand cancer. And yet we're not teaching the ordinary people nor the scientifically illiterate politicians what this means, the latent period of carcinogenesis, the toxicity of these fission products. Angela Merkel, yeah, she's a physicist, good. She understands the danger of Fukushima, good. But does she understand the radiobiology? And unless people understand this, we are doomed.
That was an excerpt from a speech I gave in Berlin in April 2011 at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Congress on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl. Thanks for listening today. Look, I know it was a fairly emotional interview on my part. I can't help it. I'm a physician, a pediatrician. How many children have I helped to die with cystic fibrosis, the most common lethal genetic disease of childhood, which will be increased in frequency down the time track by nuclear power, and over 2,000 other such diseases? How many children have I helped to die of leukemia or cancer? It's the most heart-rending experience you could possibly imagine. I'm sorry, I can't help being emotional. And I think indeed, if we're not emotional about these things, there's something wrong with us. And I often use this analogy. If I have two parents in my office and I tell them that their child has just been diagnosed with leukemia and they show no emotional response, I get them a psychiatrist because they need help with their grief. Thanks for listening today. We'll be with you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.